We don't pull video, just audio.
Is there like a rule? Is this like a therapy? Like what I say here can't be used against me in a court of law? Sweet. The floor is open then. Hey everybody, I'm Evan. Most of you know me. It's very funny sitting here. I wasn't nervous until I saw everyone from the review coming in. Then I started getting nervous. It was weird. But yeah, I'm an alcoholic. I'm an addict and I'm a codependent. I also have ADD, OCD, anxiety, and depression. And this is my circus, and these are my monkeys. Life started out pretty simply. As a young person, I had my parents and my sister. We were a pretty tight-knit family. We were definitely middle class. We didn't have a lot of money by any means, but my parents always made sure that my sister and I got to do, the things, the activities that we wanted to do. For me, it was hockey and baseball, scouts, and I did all the stuff that your average small town white kid does, and it seemed pretty normal. I realized pretty early on, though, that I was pretty sensitive as a child. I had some troubles with my emotions. I definitely had troubles dealing with kids at school and things like that. The school I went to in elementary school, there's a lot of kids there that they came from wealthy families, and I definitely did not, and they made that known. A lot of the clothes I wore were secondhand, and it was tough for me, and I got emotional about that. I didn't have a lot of close friends, but I did my best to hang in there, and I was always a good kid. I did pretty well in school. So it went on. After I think high school, going into high school after elementary school, that's when I really started to struggle a little bit with an identity. I was trying to figure out who I was and what I wanted to do. I think like most people do at that age. And I still wasn't what you would call by any means a popular kid. And there was something inside of me that really wanted a piece of that. I really wanted to be one of the popular kids. I don't know what it was about it, but there was definitely something that appealed to me. I think it was just everyone hanging out. It seemed like everyone was having a good time. I was a teenager, so I thought, well, if I'm going to get in with this group, I'm going to have to start doing some of the same things that they're doing. And that's when I started experimenting with drugs and alcohol. And it was pretty standard at first. Weekends with your buddies, going to parties in high school, drinking, smoking pot, smoking some hash. I remember the first time I ever tried to smoke hash. None of us had ever done it before, and we were trying to do bottle tokes, and the only bottle we had was an empty jar of spaghetti sauce. I don't know if any of you have ever done bottle tokes before, but an empty jar of spaghetti sauce does not work very well for that. Just for future reference, I'm just letting you know. It does leave an interesting flavor in your mouth, though. I remember it. It was probably one of the first times. And I managed to accomplish what I wanted to. I started to get in with a group. Was it the right group? I don't know at the time. I learned a lot from those guys. And it kind of introduced me to a world where I started to develop a confidence, where that the drugs and the alcohol suddenly opened up a world to me where I didn't have any inhibitions. And I started to come alive and express myself a little more. People started to take notice of it. And that was fun for me. I liked getting that attention, and it kind of grew from there. And I started, excuse me, I started kind of really liking that to the point where I wanted it. I wanted more of it. And so I started running my own businesses at that point. I was always a little bit of an entrepreneurial kid, and started up some businesses. So when I was, I guess, 16, I opened up a DJing business, and I was DJing weddings and parties and things like that. And I was making a lot of extra money, doing quite well for a kid who was 16 years old. And I had a part-time job on top of that. And I would use that money to buy drugs and alcohol and to buy drugs and alcohol for my friends. And I always had, from someone who didn't come from much. I always had nice clothes all of a sudden. I always had extra money to spend. And the people around me seemed to like me all of a sudden. I thought they liked me. It wasn't the fact that I was buying all this stuff for them or paying for the gas or driving in places. It was just they liked me. So that was fun. And that went on for quite a while. And I started to a nightclub with some friends of mine. And this is where things got really interesting. At 18 years old, opening your first nightclub is always fun, shall we say. And it kind of opened up a world for me that I had never, ever expected. And I was the center of attention. And I loved it. My ego kind of just took off. And I didn't want to look back. So leaving that behind, I think there was two more nightclubs after that we opened. And it was really just a lot of party, drugs, booze, you name it. And it was a blast. I was having a blast. I loved it. I didn't look back. And I still managed to do well in school. And during that time, I developed an interest in photography, the arts. I didn't really do well in math or science or anything like that. So it was photography for me. I decided early on that's what I wanted to do. And the drugs and the alcohol were always kind of a complement to that. It helped me kind of express myself. You know, I'm going to see the world through a different lens, so to speak, which is bullshit. But, you know, when you're a kid, you think it's going to help you take better pictures. So I finished high school. I went to Humber College in Toronto. And this is where my ego really took over, because I'd been doing photography for years up until that point. I had a part-time job at a photo studio. I had a part-time job at the newspaper. So, of course, as an arrogant 18-year-old, 19-year-old asshole at this point, I thought I knew everything. And I let it be known in school that I knew everything, and I would question the teachers and the professors, and I would, you know, help everyone who I liked do well on their projects. And that was fine for, you know, a little while, until I discovered raving, and I discovered crystal meth and MDMA. And that was, wow, that opened up a whole nother world to me. It was just constant partying. But I still was going to college, but it didn't do anything for my ego or my attitude. I was getting high at school. I was getting high in the dark rooms. Finally, the head of the department came to me, and he asked me to leave. So I had never heard of anyone being asked to leave school before. I had managed to finish my first year. And after that, I was basically told to get the fuck out, that they didn't really have a place for me, but they were going to find a job for me. So they found a job for me. I went into working in the photo studio, and I did that for a few years. But the whole time I was just drugging. I was never really much of a drinker, but the drugs really appealed to me. And it was troublesome. I started to notice it, that there was a problem. Some friends, quote unquote, saw that I had an issue with it, and they took advantage of me, and they built a meth lab in my apartment in Toronto. So that was basically a 24/7 access to all the drugs that I wanted, because I let them, you know, cook in my apartment. They would just give me drugs. And I would just stay up for days. And my life really started to get unmanageable, to the point where I decided to leave my job at the photo studio. And the day I decided to quit, a buddy of mine who was working at an ad agency downtown Toronto came up, and we went out to a gentleman's club that night to kind of celebrate me leaving work. And we drank a lot, and I did a lot of drugs, and we left the club, and I drove home, and I got caught going about 200 kilometers an hour down the Don Valley Parkway with drugs and alcohol in my system. I was arrested on the spot. Shocking, I know. And I went to jail for a few days, and that was definitely, it was a bit of an eye-opening experience. Up until that point, I had always felt like I was untouchable. My ego had always gotten the best of me, and I was fine with that. I liked my ego. I liked what I was doing. But obviously, that didn't go well. But I did manage to get off of all those charges. I'd been running from the cops for a couple of years. I missed a court date. I ran from the cops for a couple of years, moving around the city. They couldn't track me down. And then finally they did. I was driving my boss's car, and he had forgotten to change the license plate sticker on it. I got pulled over, and they found out who I was. This was 2 years after I had been initially charged, and I went to jail again. And they told me that I was going to be in a lot of trouble. I was probably going to be looking at some time in jail, in prison, and I wasn't really excited about that. And I had gotten to a point where I thought that I was turning my life around. I was working again, and I was doing really well. And the person I was working for at that point actually got me a lawyer. It was my partner, my business partner, actually. He wasn't yet, but he became my business partner after that. And he put his house up for mortgage to get me out of jail. And we then went through the court system, and he got me an incredible lawyer. And the day I was set to testify, the officer who had initially arrested me showed up, and he talked to my lawyer, and he talked to me, and he looked at me, and he asked me if I had turned my life around, and I said yes, and he left, and that was it. The cop didn't testify, so I got off of all those charges. I could have killed myself. I could have killed my friend that night. I could have killed a lot of people that night, and I didn't think anything of it. And that stayed with me for a little bit, but then the old ego kicks in, and I was like, yeah, I rock. I got off of all of that. Now I really am untouchable. I can do whatever I want. So I kept working, and the ego kept growing, and I was really, really fortunate. I managed to work at a really high level in Toronto with a lot of great people, agencies, photographers, and they had connections in New York, and there was a photographer from New York who was coming up all the time to shoot in Toronto, and I met him, and he decided that he really liked me, so he invited me to come down to New York to work for him. And that was it. I was in the big time as far as I was concerned. And so I went down to New York, and wow, holy cow, it was just like the world was my playground all of a sudden. And I was the kid standing at the top of the slide, and everybody, wanted a piece of me, and everybody wanted to work with me, and I loved it. I loved all the attention, and I loved all the free drugs and alcohol that came along with it. It was just party after party. You work hard, you play hard. We'd work for 12, 15 hours a day, and then we'd go to the bar for 4 or 5 hours, sleep for a couple, and then get up and do it all again. And it just day in, day out, it was just drugs and alcohol, drugs and alcohol. And I was just kicking the crap out of my body, but I was still doing really, really well at my job. But then it got to a point where some things fell apart. And there's a lot of side stories in here, which I'm sure if you hear me share at another point, I'll probably get into one or two of them, but tonight's not the night. But I left working with that photographer, and I left that business partner, and ended up meeting a woman, and she owned a magazine, so I went to work with her, and she had a couple of kids, so things kind of calmed down a little bit. And from a work standpoint, though, it took off again, and I kind of became an influencer before being an influencer was actually a thing. And to be that in New York was pretty exciting. At one point, I had an apartment in Miami, I had an apartment in LA, and I had an apartment York, Miami, LA, and I would just kind of go back and forth. And that was my life. I would just fly back and forth and work on jobs and work for the magazine and just have a blast. But there was still something in the back of my mind, though, that I knew that all of these things were going to catch up with me at some point. But I kind of ignored it. I didn't kind of ignored it. I ignored it. And I just pressed on. And I started to Because the woman I was seeing at the time had kids, I started to hide my using. Drinking was one thing. Everybody drank, so that seemed socially acceptable. But her son was prescribed a medication for his attention deficit disorder, ADHD. And I got a hold of it and I was like, well, I want to try this, see what it's like. And I learned very quickly that ADHD medication can be abused. And I was abusing it, and it wasn't mine, it was his. And I was stealing his medication to use it for my own devices, to keep my party going, to keep my public speaking more exciting, to keep my life more manageable, or what I thought was more manageable. And that was pretty disgusting. And you know, that's something that I still have to make amends for, and I will get to that at some point. But it was a pretty terrible thing that I did, but at the time I didn't care, right? Because I wanted to be important, and to be important, I had to keep going. I needed that energy. I needed those drugs. I needed that fuel to keep the atom fire going. And it was really exciting. It kept being exciting. And at some point in there, that woman that I was dating, her husband, her ex-husband, tried to murder me. He snuck in the middle of the night and tried to attack me. He not tried, he attacked me with a chef's knife while I was sleeping. And that was a pretty traumatic experience and sent me down a pretty dark hole for a little while. And I drank a lot to try and get over that. Something I really struggled with. And it really caused a trauma bond between myself and her. And for the next 7 years, we stuck together. When in reality, I probably should have left that relationship as soon as that happened. Probably would have been the best thing to do, but hey, hindsight's 20/20, right? after that, I got deported. We were supposed to get married, and she was telling me that she was going to get her divorce papers done from her previous relationship, and she didn't. We went away on a trip. I came back into New York, and they deported me. So I was done. That was my 10 years in the US, and I'm still not welcome back today. Something I will work on, and hopefully someday I will be able to visit the United States of America again. But for right now, it's kind of out of the cards, and that's another consequence of my actions. It was something that I blamed her for, when in reality I should have been taking care of my own shit. But at the time, I didn't care, right? Somebody else's fault. It's not mine. So I came back to Canada and went to Toronto, and yeah, I was working for a startup. I kind of lost interest in the city and wanted to get back to my roots. So I moved back to my hometown, Cobourg, Ontario, which is just on Lake Ontario, just down the road from Kingston a little bit, about an hour and a half. And it was the small town I remembered. And I kind of took a little joy in the peacefulness of it. I'd gotten away from all the drugs and thought I was going to be okay. But that's when alcohol became a huge part of my life, because there was kind of a boredom there. I used alcohol to kind of just make up for it. And I got into another relationship. You know, shocking, right? Relationships. Did I mention I'm codependent? Yeah. And so there was another 7 year relationship there. And that relationship was built on a foundation of drinking. There were good times and there were bad times, but there was a lot of drinking, and everyone I surrounded myself with drank. It just was a small town thing to do. You got together, you went to the bar, you drank. But it was really starting to have an impact on my life and my performance at work. You know, I had finally managed to get a job back in my small town doing something I wanted to do, a small agency. They were quite successful. So they brought me in, this, you know, big shot from New York City that was going to turn things around. And I really fucked it up. You know, a lot of it was my drinking, and it was because I wasn't, you know, performing the best I could. But it wasn't my fault, it was someone else's fault. They were lucky to just have me there, right? Because I was Adam from New York, and that was my ego again, and it just kept getting in the way. But it couldn't possibly be my fault, so I would just drink. And then it started to happen with my relationship as well. You know, it was, I wanted to control every aspect of every moment that was happening around me. And when I couldn't, I would drink. And when I could, I would drink. And really, what happened at the end of it all is I really had just built this dollhouse. You know, those pretty little dollhouses where they got all the little furniture set up and everything is right where it's supposed to be. That's what I had done with my life. I put it in a box, a little house where I thought everything was perfect. I had everything that I wanted and it looked good. It looked good for people looking at it. And in reality, it was a shit show. But nobody could see that because I had all the pretty pictures in place. And, you know, I was the guy that had all the stuff. That was when people would come over, it would just be out. You could see it. I would even buy books and just have them on my bookshelf so people could see that I would have those books. And sometimes I'd pull them out and put them on my desk and open them to a certain page so people thought I was reading that book. And I would just, you know, talk. Just get a few drinks into me. And I thought I was the smartest guy in the room. And everyone was just lucky to be around me. And that's what alcohol did to me. It turned me into an asshole. I was not the smartest guy in the room. I was the asshole in the room. But no one really told me, or so I thought. The whole time people had been telling me, I was just ignoring them because I knew better than them. I was better than them. That's what I thought. But it got to a point where it all came crashing down. And my partner at the time basically said, it's time for you to go. We had said it was going to be a trial separation. And I went down east to stay with some friends. In that period of time, my partner and I decided to cut ties completely. That was messy. And I was just drinking the whole time. And drinking just made everything worse. You know, I thought, I'm just going to have a drink to take the edge off. But it just made it worse. It made everything worse. But you couldn't convince me of that. It was something I thought that I needed. And then what I realized, what it was, is that I had just accepted the fact that I was an alcoholic and that I was okay with it, that this was my destiny, this is who I was going to be. My grandfather was an alcoholic. Disease killed him. It'd probably do the same to me, but I'm not going to stop, right? It's too late now. I like drinking. I don't like who it makes me, but oh well, it's who I am, right? And that was really, really tough for people around me to accept. And after I'd been asked to leave my home, I lost my job, I lost my family, I lost my home. I went down east, I stayed with some friends. After a few months, they asked me to leave. They couldn't handle having me around. And that was really tough because the woman that was is a friend of mine still. She has 25 years sobriety, and I was starting to lean on her almost as a sponsor. She couldn't handle that. She had her own things to deal with. And I had a lot of resentment towards her and her husband for that. You know, them asking me to leave. How dare they? They were the ones that told me to come out there. This was, you know, obviously, again, it was someone else's fault. It couldn't possibly be something I had done. So I came back to Kingston and ended up staying with my sister. And that lasted only a few months before she asked me to leave. Because she couldn't handle the stress of having me downstairs because I was just drinking all the time. And, you know, my little nephew was there and I couldn't spend quality time with him. I was always making excuses. I was always sneaking out the back and having a drink or a smoke. And I wasn't spending any quality time with my family. And then she asked me to leave and said, it's just too much. So where else do you go after that? I went back to my mom and dad, and they said I could come and stay with them as long as I went to treatment. So I managed to get into treatment, and there was a long waiting list, though, and they said I had to go to meetings twice a week until I was accepted into treatment or, you know, my bed opened up. And that lasted 5 months. So for 5 months, I went to 2 meetings a week. Well, I actually ended up going to 3 meetings a week at some point because I started going to the review as well. But it was there I started to see an answer, something that was actually could help me get out of this idea of what I thought I was destined to become. And for the first 4 months, I wasn't sober. I still went to meetings, but I didn't go to meetings when I was drinking. But I was still drinking. And then that fifth month, I decided I had finally seen enough of what I wanted. I wanted what these people had. You know, I always thought my life was going to be boring. You know, what am I going to do if I can't drink? I'm just going to sit at home and what? I don't know. I didn't know. I had no idea what to expect. But when I went into the rooms and I met these people, they were smiling and they were laughing and they were having a good time. And I was like, what the fuck is going on here? Aren't you a bunch of alcoholics? Shouldn't you all be depressed, angry? And they weren't. I saw shining eyes. I saw smiles. I saw people welcome me with open arms. The first meeting I went to is where I met my sponsor. And it had been tough for me because I do struggle with some mental health issues. I had been to a traditional meeting and I'd met some old timers that had told me if I was using any kind of medication that I wasn't really sober. And that was very hard for me to deal with as someone struggling with mental health issues. So I went to a secular meeting, and that was my Monday night secular meeting, Journey Through Recovery. And that's when I met my people, so many people that had what I wanted, but no one more than my sponsor. I saw this guy and I was like, that's the guy. And I hadn't even been to treatment yet. So I went to treatment and I thought I was a recovery pro going into treatment because I had had a few months of meetings under my belt. So I was ready to go into treatment and work on my step four, because that's what you do when you're in treatment. You work on step four. Kind of a ridiculous idea. My counselors told me so. And, you know, I struggled with that a bit. I still tried to do it on my own, but in the end, they won out and they did a really great job. They're a really amazing group of people that helped me through a lot. And while I was there in treatment, I opened up a lot and I started to think about my life a lot. And there's a lot that came back from my past that I had blocked out. I realized that I had been sexually abused as a child by a hockey coach, and that was a really tough thing for me to handle. And I thought, well, if there's any reason to go out and drink, this is probably it. And it didn't, because I had people now that could help me with that. I had people I could talk to. I had people I could share that with. I didn't have to carry that burden alone, and that was an amazing feeling. You know, they say that there's a spiritual awakening that happens when you're working on your steps. And for me, that was the idea of connection. That was my spiritual awakening. That whole time I had been out there searching for this connection with these people through these substances and thought I was building these meaningful relationships with people. And they were going to save me. They were going to be my friends. We were going to be together forever. And it was so shallow. And that's not what I found in recovery. I found depth of friendship. I found connection. And connection is the opposite of addiction. And working my steps was challenging. I continue to work on making amends with people, but I do that every day. You know, my sponsor is a firm believer in living amends, and he's passed that on to me. And I do my review every night, and I try and make sure the problems don't happen. But when they do, I try and fix it as quickly as possible. I try and be as present as possible. And in order to do that, I try and get involved in my recovery as much as possible. You know, I go to 12 to 15 meetings a week. I'm a secretary at my home group. I'm an admin at the review. I chair a couple of times a week. I really love my recovery life. And I don't do all of that because I have to. I do all of that because I want to. Because it's here that I found my people. It's here that I found my true friend in my family. The connections that I always wanted, that I needed. That keeps me spiritually well, is being connected to those people. And when I don't have that connection, I can feel it right away. I miss it. Right? If work gets busy and I miss a couple of meetings, I can feel that. And I need to get to a meeting. You know, it's important to me. All of this is important to me. That's why I keep my recovery at the forefront of my life. People say it's important to stay involved in recovery, but for me, it's everything. And I don't know what I would have done if I hadn't found these rooms. I'm not sure where I would be today, and I don't think about it anymore because I know that I'm in the right place now. I know I'm where I need to be because I'm 446 days sober and I've never felt better. And I still struggle. I still have bad days. I still get depressed. I have mental health issues I need to deal with. I take medications for it. Sometimes I forget. That doesn't go well. And I have to remember that I'm not perfect. I don't need to be perfect. I just need to be me. And that's the opportunity that this recovery has given me, is the opportunity to just be me. I don't have to pretend anymore. I don't have to build any pretty houses for anyone to look at. I am who I am. And I love that. It took me a long, long, long time to get here. But I got here, and it was worth it. And I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing because it feels good. Recovery feels good. Being sober feels good. I've never felt this good before in my life. I'm still going to have shitty days. But when I have a shitty day, I can pick up the phone and I can call my sponsor. I can call my friends. I can call my family because they've all welcomed me back into their lives, which has been a really incredible thing, something I thought might never happen. And the people I called friends before that aren't there anymore, they were never really my friends to begin with, and I don't miss them. And I don't really care if they miss me because I'm right where I want to be. So if I can leave you with this, my recovery, there's five things. Change your life, be completely honest, ask for help, practice self-care, and don't bend the rules. And one more thing, one of my favorite quotes from a gentleman named Leonard Cohen, there's a crack in everything, that's where the light gets in. And we're all a little bit broken, and that's okay, because that's where the light gets in. So thanks for having me tonight and letting me share. I'm Adam. I'm an alcoholic and addict and a codependent.